Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello, this is Tim Reedy for the America Magazine podcast, the week of March 8th, and we have with us once again Father Jim Martin. Welcome, Father Jim.
Thanks. Good to be here, Tim.
Now, we're here to talk about your new book, The Jesuit Guide to Almost Everything, which comes out this month, March. What's the official pub date?
March 9th.
March 9th.
Feast of St. Francis of Rome, for those who are paying attention.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll mark that on your calendars. And we're happy that this is one of the first interviews you're doing about the book. Now, Father Jim, The Jesuit Guide to Almost Everything. Now, this seems like pretty comprehensive what you're setting out to do here. Can one spirituality, we're talking about Ignatian spirituality here, be capacious enough to tackle kind of all of different kinds of issues one faces in life?
Well, Ignatian spirituality could be summarized as finding God in all things. It is capacious enough to invite people to find God in their daily life, in prayer, in work, in relationships, you know, as well as in the more overtly spiritual parts that we normally consider to be appropriate, to use a popular word like church, prayer, scripture readings, things like that. So the book really tries to introduce this, you know, broad spirituality to a general audience.
Right. You were saying that earlier before we started recording, that this is not just for a Catholic audience. You were trying to introduce, I mean, this is a mainstream publisher, Harper One now.
Change your mind. Change the name, right?
But you're as you're saying this, this is not just for the Christian reader even.
Yeah, I think most books, as good as they are on Ignatian spirituality or Jesuit spirituality, really are addressed more to the Catholic population. They sometimes assume that you know what a Jesuit is. I mean, I talk about what a Jesuit is for people in the book. So this is really for everybody. This is for everyone from the doubtful seeker to the devout believer. I try to explain Ignatian spirituality and some of the know-how and the sort of techniques, decision-making, for example, to people who wouldn't know the first thing about being a Jesuit. But I also say that, you know, to understand Ignatian spirituality, you really have to understand that it is all centered on God and specifically Jesus.
Now, you've set out quite a mission for yourself here because, as you point out, you know, when you talk to Jesuits, when you talk to, I think that it's an Italian setting, three Jesuits, four opinions.
Right, right, exactly.
So trying to get kind of a definitive account of Jesuit spirituality, that's not necessarily what you're trying to do here.
No, not at all. I want to set that sort of state that at the beginning. No, and I say in the first chapter, this is not exhaustive. It's certainly not authoritative. I mean, there are, you know, hundreds, probably thousands of books on Jesuit spirituality from different points of view. And it's not scholarly either. It's not, you know, to sort of pick apart the spiritual exercises or St. Ignatius's life. But it is accessible, and it's trying to be inviting. And I do think it's probably the first book that is addressed to everyone, not just Jesuits or graduates of Jesuit high schools or even Catholics, but really anyone can pick up this book, you know, who has a average intelligence and an interest in God and sort of get something from it.
You draw on various sources here, but maybe we can start with the Ignatian sources, the writings that he wrote during his life, and of course the primary one being the spiritual exercises, which I'd like to point out, as you note in your book, wasn't the title originally. The original title was Spiritual Exercises to Overcome Oneself and to Order One's Life Without Reaching a Decision Through Some Disordered Affection. Now, as editors, we would say that doesn't work at all.
That's
so
right.
Spiritual exercises, whoever decided to make it shorter, I think was making the right decision there. But maybe we can talk about some of the ideas introduced in that
right.
title, specifically disordered affections and you know, how that plays into Jesuit spirituality.
No, that's a great question. And, you know, the fact that he put that in the original title means it's an important concept for St. Ignatius. I mean, basically, a disordered affection would be, you know, something you're inclined to. So it's an affection, let's say something like a love of money or sort of status or something like that. It's disordered in that it's not oriented or ordered towards something life-giving. So, for example, the example I use in the book is, you know, if you're completely obsessed with making money and you start to see that sort of as your God, you know, you start to sacrifice things as a result. So maybe you won't spend time with people who aren't going to advance your career. You won't spend time with your family. You'll order everything towards sort of this pursuit of money. Now, that doesn't mean that making money is somehow evil, but if it's disordered, St. Ignatius says it's preventing you from being free, and it's preventing you from getting closer to God. So that's part of the what I talk about in the book. It's a lot of the book is about freedom and sort of finding the freedom to be the person you're meant to be, finding the freedom to be happy, and really finding the freedom to be closer to God. So, but yeah, disordered affections is certainly an important topic in Ignatian spirituality.
And of course, you mentioned In All Things Before, and it may sound self-explanatory, and since we use it as the title of our blog, maybe you can just go into a little more detail about what it means to seek to find God in all things.
Sure. You know, well, funny enough, Ignatius doesn't use that in any of his writings. It's one of the early Jesuits who's quoting Ignatius, saying that, you know, we as Master Ignatius, as they would call him, they didn't call him St. Ignatius back then, as Master Ignatius would say, God must be found in all things. And that's been taken as a kind of shorthand for Jesuit spirituality, which means that, you know, when you look at your life, when you pray about your life, when you think about your life, certain things that most people would think would be quote-unquote outside the realm of spirituality, like, for example, you know, sexuality or work problems, something like that, are actually ways of encountering God, and that, you know, spirituality can inform those kinds of things. One story I'd like to tell is one of my early spiritual directors, a fellow named David Donovan, who died a few years ago, who I talk about a lot in the book, said to me once, I tell the story, that I was coming to him. There were some problems in my family, and I said I was worried about them. Oh, no, I wasn't talking about them, and he said, is there something bothering you? And I said, well, there's something happening in my family that I was upset about, but I didn't want to bring it up in spiritual direction when we were meeting at that point. And he said, well, you know, you can't take a particular part of your life, put it in a box, stick it in a shelf, and not look at it. You have to bring that box down, open it up, and look at it with God, basically. So finding God in all things means that there's no part of your life that you have to stick in a box and hide away from God. It's all part of your spiritual life. When that image has always stuck with me, that there's nothing that's outside of God's love, basically, and there's nothing outside of our spiritual lives. Everything can be brought in.
Now, one of the first questions you address in your book is, how do I find God, which is kind of elemental. And you lay out these six paths of kind of paths to God. And as I was reading them, it struck me that, as you note, that it's not just path of belief, as you say, you know, born into the faith. You even mention here a path of unbelief. Maybe, as we were saying earlier, maybe atheists wouldn't agree with you here, but do you see as unbelief as one potential path to God?
Well, I do, and in the book I talk about sort of benefits and pitfalls of each of those paths. You know, there is the path of belief, and one of the benefits of that is that, you know, you feel you're close to God. You know, your life has meaning given to it by God, but one of the pitfalls of the path of belief is you might be a little judgmental of people that aren't on that. I think one of the benefits of the path of disbelief would be that they can think very critically about religion, and they don't take sort of pat answers, you know, for granted. One of the pitfalls of that is that they sometimes say, the agnostic or the atheist, demand that God's presence be proved to them intellectually, which of course we know is, you know, close to impossible. But I do think that any of these paths, if followed sincerely, will lead to God. And the reason I believe that is because I believe that sort of inchoate longing that we have, you know, for understanding, for something more, for something greater than what we are, that everybody feels, you know, as St. Augustine said, our hearts are restless until they rest in thee. You know, that leads to God, basically. And everyone, even those who are non-believers, have that. And so if they follow this path sincerely, you know, even this path of disbelief, it will eventually, through questioning and reflection, I hope, lead them to God. And that's one of the things I try to talk about in the book.
As I was reading through this book, it struck me that it doesn't look to me like a book you could have written 10 years ago or when you were in your early stages of Jesuit formation, because you draw on so much here, not just the constitutions, the exercises, but also works of Jesuits, Avery Dulles, Karl Rahner. Is that correct, that this is kind of a product of years and years of reading and spiritual research?
It is. I mean, you know, someone asked me how long it took me to write the book, and I said 21 years, because mm-hmm. that's how long I've been a Jesuit. I think, you know, if I'd written it 10 years ago, certainly I wouldn't have really understood as much about Ignatian spirituality. I've done a lot of spiritual direction, for example. I've taken practicum courses in the spiritual exercises, and I've read, as you pointed out, you know, more books about the Jesuit saints and Jesuit history. I also, you know, I'm older. I'm 49 years old. I have a little more life experience, and so I think I've lived and have also experienced, you know, through other people, problems that they've had, and so I hope that it sort of speaks to, you know, a lot of experience in real life, basically, which is the subtitle of Spirituality for Real Life. So I hope it's, you know, a more mature book than I would have written 10 years ago.
Now, as you mentioned, obviously, you know, you invoke people, as I said earlier, like Avery Dulles and, you know, notable Jesuits, but you also draw on people like your spiritual director, David Donovan,
yeah.
And people who perhaps you don't name in the book, but your brother Jesuits who have influenced you over the years. So it seems this is infused not just with, you know, kind of the big name Jesuits, but also, you know, people who have kind of walked along the path with you over the years.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, for me, that's a really important way of learning about Jesuit spirituality through Jesuits, and also through, I should be really clear, also through sisters and lay people who have walked along what I call the way of Ignatius. But yeah, I think it's really important to sort of bring in real life examples of people who are wisdom figures for me. A lot of my spiritual directors, you know, are named in the book. I usually don't use last names, but I talk about Jeff and Damien and people like that, people who have also gone to God, who have really helped me at difficult times and at different times, and have also given me a lot of wisdom. I mean, I basically try in this book to pass along all the wisdom as far as possible that I've learned from a lot of these great wisdom figures. And I've talked also pretty personally about some of my own experiences and struggles, you know, as a Jesuit and as a human being, and where these people have helped me. So, you know, the general sort of goal or mission for the Society of Jesus is to help souls, and I hope this book helps some souls. And one of the ways I try to do it is by talking about problems that I faced and what these wisdom figures and what the wisdom of Saint Ignatius has said to me about those problems.
Now, as you surveyed, you know, Jesuit history, which you must have done to write this book, did you notice, I mean, obviously the spiritual exercises have been around for 500 years, they haven't changed, but in terms of the emphasis that the order has placed on them versus, you know, the order maybe at one point it was more into building institutions, how has that changed over its history?
Oh, that's another good question. I think that the most significant change recently in the exercises has been the rise of privately directed retreats. From what I understand in the past, it was much more preached retreats where you would go in and a retreat master would preach, you know, I hate to say this, but, you know, at you. That still happens, but it's a little more collaborative. Now it's much more on one-on-one retreats and direction, and that's really recovering something that St. Ignatius, you know, intended early on. You know, in the Second Vatican Council, when religious orders were asked to return to their roots, this was one of the things that was discovered, that in a sense, you know, Ignatius meant for this one-on-one spiritual conversations, spiritual companionship or spiritual friendship, which is why spiritual direction, which I talk a lot about in the book, has really, you know, risen in popularity since, say, the 1960s and 1970s. But it really gets back to that really revolutionary at the time notion of Ignatius's, which was that the creator, i.e. God, can deal with the creature directly, so that we can have an immediate experience of God's grace and God's love in our life. That does not deny the importance of Christianity or Catholicism or the Church, but that God through, and I talk about this in a chapter about how we experience desires for God in different ways that people might overlook, you know, like, for example, feelings of incompletion. We have these direct experiences of God in our lives with sometimes without even knowing it. And what I'm trying to say is that these are authentic experiences. And that's one thing to loop around to your question. That's one thing that I think has been recovered, this sense of the person as a locus of God's activity, even people who might not be aware of it.
Well, I think that's a good way to put it. A lot of this was recovered, and as I know that Pedro Ruppe was often called mm-hmm. the second founder of the
right.
order, because presumably he helped kind of mm-hmm. rediscover some of these things. One of them is the notion of contemplatives in action, which you mentioned in the book, which is kind of a very modern notion when you think about it. Yet it's, you know, this term was coined, you know, in the 15th century, 16th century.
Yeah. Right, and it's also, you know, it's something that someone said also about St. Ignatius. You know, apparently he would say this a lot. You know, someone would quote Ignatius saying, you know, we must be contemplatives likewise in action. And that's also another shorthand. I give sort of four shorthand definition of Jesuit spirituality in the book. And it's an idea of having a contemplative stance in the middle of an active life. So I think most of the readers of this book, but, you know, some of them might be, are not in monasteries or cloistered in convents. They're out in the world. They're mothers and fathers and business people and teachers and lawyers and doctors. And yet they can still have this contemplative awareness of their active lives. I talk about ways of doing that through the examination of conscience, which is a particular form of prayer that Ignatius popularized. But that stance, that kind of contemplative stance where the world, in a sense, is your monastery, is very helpful. It's certainly a goal. I think I should also say that. It's, you know, sometimes we can, you know, be unaware and just be reflective, but it is a wonderful goal, I think, that St. Ignatius holds out for us.
Yes, and I mean, that notion of contemplatives in action certainly seems to have been kind of really taken seriously by those engaged in direct social action, social justice, which seems to be a new focus of the order since Vatican II. Would that be correct?
Yeah, I think so. You know, Ignatius, you know, originally one of the first things he did was, for example, he founded a home for reformed prostitutes and their children. He was working with the poor. You know, St. Aloysius Gonzaga, one of the early Jesuit saints, died helping plague victims in Rome. So, you know, working with the poor was a constitutive part of their mission. And that was recovered, I think, more in the 1960s, as you said, with Pedro Urrupe. And as you say, that contemplative and action model is particularly important for people who are doing social justice work. You know, the model of what they say is action, reflection, and action. You know, you do something, you reflect on it prayerfully, and then you might change course a bit and act on it. Otherwise, you know, you become completely hyperactive and tied up really also into results, too. I talk a lot about in the book about leaving things to God. I think, you know, one of the great dangers of people who are doing social justice work or working with the poor, I mean, for example, I worked in East Africa and saw this among, I would say, more secular workers, is this idea of getting burned out. You know, so if you're only looking to the results and seeing not much change, then you might get a little burned out and a little discouraged. I think the person who's a contemplative in action, for example, will be reminded that this is not your work. It's God's work, and you might not see the results, for example. So that's one of the things I talk about in the book, that the contemplative in action also realizes whose work it ultimately is.
Now, as I said earlier, I mean, this is a very rich book. There's a lot here. I mean, if somebody just wanted to, you know, some tips for praying, you could go here. You mentioned the examine. What are some of the other types of prayer that you mentioned in the book?
Well, I talk about there are certain kind of Ignatian prayers, or at least prayer methods that are more affiliated or associated with St. Ignatius. The big one, of course, is what I call Ignatian contemplation, which is also called, there's one of the problems with some of these prayer types is that what one person calls contemplation, another person calls meditation, another person calls Ignatian contemplation. Some people call it composition of place. It's where you imaginatively put yourself in the gospel scene. And actually, we have on our website and on our YouTube page, we have a couple vlogs or vlogs, I guess you say, talking about Ignatian contemplation. Essentially, it's imagining yourself and trusting that God can work through your imagination as you place yourself in a gospel scene or scene from the Old Testament and say, what do I see? What do I hear? What do I feel? What do I smell? And seeing what kind of emotions, insights, memories, desires arise in your prayer. I'll tell you a story about David Donovan. I was originally introduced to this form of prayer in the novitiate, and I thought, well, gee, imagining God, I mean, or imagining myself, you know, in front of God or in front of Jesus, isn't that just sort of making stuff up in my head? It seemed a little ridiculous. I actually thought it was foolish. And David sort of nodded, and he said, well, do you think God can work through relationships? And I said, well, yes. And he said, can God work through church and mass? And I said, yes. I know I was being set up for an answer. And what about your emotions? I said, yeah. And how about your desires? Yes. And he said, well, why can't God work through your imagination? And I have to say that really unlocked it for me. I thought, well, of course, if you're a sincere believer and you're trying to reach God, why can't God work through your imagination? That doesn't mean that everything you imagine is God, but in these sort of intentional, sincere prayer experiences, you really can meet God in a new way. So that's one way. I talk a little bit about Lectio Divina, too, which is also part of the spiritual exercises. And then also a part of the exercises, which I think is kind of hidden, is what goes by the name centering prayer today, which is sort of being quiet and finding God at the center, which actually is in the exercises if you look carefully enough.
What does, you know, Jesuit spirituality have to offer? You know, obviously this was, a lot of this was written 16th century, largely for an ordained order of men. What does it have to offer, you know, women, lay people? For example, you have a chapter here on chastity, celibacy, and love. You know, what do Ignatius' writings on chastity have to offer a modern audience?
Right, right. The glib answer would be, oh, buy the book and find out. Well, you know, funny enough, even from the beginning, Ignatius was giving the exercises, you know, not simply to Jesuits, but other priests, sisters, lay people. And from the beginning, he was intending it for the widest possible audience. And, you know, I always like to remind people that, you know, when Ignatius first began his spiritual journey after his conversion in around 1521, he was a layman, right? So the things that he was experiencing and the ideas that he poured into his book, The Spiritual Exercises, about his spiritual journey, you know, happened to a layman. So he's writing this really for everyone. But, you know, for example, chastity, I take halfway through the book, I look at poverty, chastity, and obedience, the traditional religious vows that all people in religious orders take. And I say, you know, what can that teach us? What can that teach the regular, the general reader? From chastity, I take the idea that we can learn a lot about love and friendship, because chastity really is about loving freely. And, you know, when you think about it, most of the people in our lives, you know, other than, say, our spouses, we're going to be loving chastely, you know, our friends, people in our family, things like that. So how can you love freely? How can you be a good friend? That's a big chapter in there. And I try to give some not only advice based on the spiritual exercises, but also advice from friends and wisdom figures about loving. Because really, you know, chastity in the end, as all the vows are about love.
Well, we will now recommend that people go out and buy the book, because there's so much here we can't possibly cover it all. But the official title is The Jesuit Guide to Almost Knows That in Parentheses. Almost.
Yeah, that my editor and I went back and forth. They wanted the almost in parentheses to make it clear that it was kind of funny and tongue-in-cheek.
Well, Jesuit Guide to Almost Everything, out on the books stand March 9th. Pre-order it on Amazon now. But we want to thank Father Jim Martin and wish him the best.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot, Tim.
I want to thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the American Magazine Podcast. Check online this week. We have a special slideshow of photographs chronicling the political crisis in Honduras, and that accompanies an article by Tim Padgett on Central America. You should also check our homepage, where we every week put up a video commentary from one of our editors. This week we have Associate Editor Kevin Clark. A reminder that you can respond to our podcast by going to americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.